Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
For 25 years, Seth Lightman has seen it all. From the newest electric car revolution, solar power, bike lanes made in NYC. And now we are here. More electric cars, need for more renewables and eco-friendly products in our world. Well, now it's time for an all-out podcast for this time. You're listening to The Green Living Guy Show. He's funny, real, exactly on point. And some think his style is so raw, it's crazy. Let's do this, folks. It's time for The Green Living Guy Show with Seth Lightman.
What's up, everybody? It's Green Living Guy. Wow, it's been a crazy couple of weeks. It's beautiful out. We had some crazy weather over here, but we're going to continue talking about one of the most important conversations that I've had in a while regarding Judaism and regarding, as I've said in my last interview, with the three IDF soldiers, keeping it green. You know, I'm here right now fighting for my people's life. So I am giving up this podcast for a while to not just talk about green living, but to talk about Judaism, October 7th, and what we need to do to fight for Judaism and fight for what's right, folks. You know, when they talk about standing up for women, I even brought it up to those IDF soldiers. I feel like there's a massive disconnect in the world. But today we have one of the most amazing guests that I've had in a long time on my show. Her name is Ellie Cohenim. Ellie worked as a deputy, and I want to make sure I get this right. And Ellie, you can stop me, of course. But Ellie was deputy envoy to the UN for anti-Semitism.
Hi, Seth. So hello. The title, and it's a long one because it's government.
I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it. I'll just clarify. Yeah. I served as the deputy special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism at the U.S. State Department.
State Department.
Exactly.
Well, then you were really plugged in with the federal government. God, thank Hashem, you were doing the right thing. And it's an important task, to say the least, what you did. Let's first, and I do this with all of my interviewees, so don't, this is going to be standard format here because of what we're talking about, but I'd love to hear how you got there, because I know that's a story in itself. So tell me what got you involved in international affairs. I know it's, you know, from the State Department, but also in the issue regarding anti-Semitism. I think that's really something I think our audience needs to know. How did it all start for you?
Well, if I have to tell you how it all started, I would go back to the very beginning of my biography, if I may, which is that I was born in Iran in 1972, at a time when the Shah, the king of Iran, was in power, and the Persian Jews are one of the most ancient Jewish communities, dating back to the biblical story of Queen Esther and the holiday of Purim, and so really dating back to the first temple, the destruction of the first temple in Jerusalem, and then the Jews wind up in ancient Persia and Iraq, which becomes
one of my kids' favorite holidays. But that's an important time and an important story about Iranian Jews. So continue, please. Please.
So if you imagine for over 2,000 years, it's something like 2,500 years plus. The Jews lived in ancient Persia, which becomes modern day Iran, and the Jews were in Iran before the Islamic conquest. So this is how ancient our community is. And so we obviously the Jewish community dealt with different rulers over these thousands of year period, and there were good times under different Muslim leaders and bad times. But you know, we persisted, we lived, and so you fast forward to 1979 when there is this radical Islamic revolution and the Ayatollah Khomeini comes into power, and a lot of people feel like President Jimmy Carter betrayed the Shah of Iran. That's a whole other story. But so the Shah is also sick at the time, but with cancer, and the population is not necessarily aware of what's going on. But in any case, so you have the Khomeini come in, radical Islamic revolution takes power. And one of the first things that the regime did was they executed the president of the Jewish community, Mr. Habib Elvanayan. Right. And at that point, a community of 100,000 Jews, we got the signal that if they could kill the head of the community, they could kill any of us. And the accusation against Mr. Elvanayan was that he was, quote unquote, a Zionist spy. And Seth, just to share a tiny bit about my family, my dad had in Iran a large construction works company, and one of the government bids that he succeeded in getting was a water project that the Shah was undertaking. And so my dad brought in Israeli water engineers to Iran in the 1970s because that's how close the relationship when. Under the Shah, Iran and Israel had formal diplomatic relations, and there was a lot of back and forth between the two countries. And so my dad brought in Israeli water engineers, so even back then we're some of the best in the world with water technology.
Yep.
So he brings in these engineers, they do the project, they leave. When the Islamic revolution starts and there's these accusations of Zionist spies, at the time there was somebody who owed my dad money. He went to try to collect the money. And the person said to him, listen to me, Kohanim, you come back here again, I'm going to report you as a Zionist spy.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I remember this time growing up and remembering the hostages and the all of that stuff. So to hear you bring this up is just talk about memory flashback. And then to hear your context toward it even makes it further hard to hear because of what happened to our Persian brothers and sisters like yourself. So go ahead. I'm sorry. I just had to interject that.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Seth. And so my dad at the time understood this as a credible threat against his life. And so we literally picked up. I was a small child. We picked up and ran for our lives. We left Iran early enough in the revolution that we were able to get on an airplane and leave. After that point, they made it illegal for people to try to leave the country. And so other Jews who stayed behind, including my own family members, had to then escape on horseback and donkey back across the borders of Turkey and places like that. So we were fortunate that we were able to get on an airplane. But I have to share with you, Seth, that my family had to leave everything behind. You know, so my father had been a successful man. He had been working since he was 14 years old to create a nice life for his family, and he had to just drop everything and run. But we did that for our personal safety. It was the best decision I think my parents ever made. And we were so blessed to find refuge in the United States. We came to New York City, and we settled in New York City. And again, we know that America is the greatest country in the world. And we are just so fortunate and blessed that we were given refuge here. But Seth, back to your question about being tapped for this deputy special envoy position at the State Department.
Yes.
The reason I believe I was tapped for it was because I personally am a victim of vicious, violent radical Islamist anti-Semitism. I was just a child when the revolution happened in Iran, but you know, this happened to me. I was a Jew, and this is such a common theme of Jewish history. I was a Jew living in a country where we had survived for thousands of years, and yet one day there is a political change in the country that changes the atmosphere from one where it is welcoming, warm, and allows the Jewish community to flourish, to overnight hostile, vicious, and violent towards Jews, where Jews were no longer safe to live there. And so this is my life story. I, as a child, had to flee my own home, flee my homeland, and escape for my life. And my belief is that, you know, partially it was my personal history and understanding the seriousness of the threat of anti-Semitism, which is something that's just, you know, it's my life story and what I've grown up with. And partially the fact that I believe I've always been maybe a loud advocate on these issues, you know, again, trying to ring alarm bells about the threat of anti-Semitism, trying to ring alarm bells specifically about the threat of the Islamic Republic of Iran regime and the threat that the regime poses to the world, and also, you know, support and defense of Israel. So you know, that's what I believe qualified me for the position when the Trump administration reached out to me for it.
That's great. And I'm grateful for your service. I'm grateful that you were tapped. It's unfortunate what happened to you, to say the least. And I have, in the United States, suffered from anti-Semitism, but to leave your country is definitely something that, let's just say that my great-grandparents had to deal with, but not me. Part of my family goes back to the Bielski partisans, but so we fought against the Nazis, but we did not fight against the Shah. But I do know it's a serious thing, and it, you know, Iran, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, how Iran is kind of intertwined with the issues going on from October 7th. You know, I believe we're almost in a proxy war going on here, and they're propagating this or adding fuel to the fire, as I would say. I'm curious what you think about Iran now, and what's gone on after, during, and after October 7th.
Seth, you're exactly right about the Islamic Republic of Iran and the very big role they played on the October 7th massacre and attack of Hamas on Israel. And it is a proxy war that Israel, and I would venture to say the West, is fighting right now against the Islamic Republic. And so just to share some background on that, the Islamic Republic of Iran regime has created a strategy that I would say has worked out really well for them, of funding, training, and arming different terror groups that act as the Islamic Republic's proxy. So you're talking about Hamas in Gaza. You're talking about Palestinian Islamic Jihad in the West Bank. You're talking about Hezbollah in Lebanon, and you're talking about the Houthis in Yemen and Kataib Hezbollah and different militias in Iraq. And what they've done is they've created a strategy that works very well for them, because they have the proxies kind of attack Israel and Western forces, American forces, I should say, as well, on behalf of the Iranians. But because it's the proxies that carry out the attacks, it's also the proxies that bear the burden of retaliation. And so what it's done is that it's kept the Iranian homeland safe from counterattack for the most part. So this has been a very successful strategy for them. And there have been a number of voices, both in Israel and in the U.S., who have said, you know, enough is enough. we need to stop going after the proxies and we need to go for the head of the snake, the head of the octopus.
Yeah, I agree.
And right. And so, you know, so that is definitely, I think, a national conversation in the United States that has to take place.
So when I hate to use certain, you know, I try to stay in talking about ideas, but when you have such divisive a crowd in our halls of Congress right now, aka the squad and their supportive staff crew that we're trying to, you know, democratically also get out of power. But what does that, at least I know what it makes me feel, but I just want people to hear, what does it make you feel when you hear them chanting from the river to the sea with, and you know, Rashida knows about what this means. And then you have people like AOC and that whole crew who just want nothing but the destruction to the Jews. Is mesmerizing that we're still allowing them to be in the house, but that they're continuing this chant. They protest in front of the White House, and there were only four Jews to combat it. It's just mesmerizing what has allowed to occur in the United States government and now in the halls of Congress. So I really want to hear what your thoughts are on Congress and how it's maybe even reached into parts of the government as well.
Well, yeah. So Seth, it has reached into parts of the government, but to stay on the subject of Congress first, you know, the AOC district in New York is white, educated, upper class liberals who voted AOC into office. And Ilhan Omar's district is very similar. I always thought, you know, that she has a huge Somali population in her district. And I actually met a couple of the candidates who've run against her, and they educated me and told me, no, this is, again, white, highly educated, well-to-do liberals are the majority of Ilhan Omar's district. Now, Rashida Tlaib's district is a bit different. It is more a majority Arab population. So here's what the takeaway from understanding the districts and who's voting these people in, who have been called the Hamas caucus, and rightfully so.
If
you look at the
I'm
squad,
dealing with a congressman myself right now in my in a district right below me, but you'll know who I'm talking about. My county executive is running against him, Jamal Bowman, who wants to bring in Gazans into the district who have been displaced.
I mean, And there's no end to the
only way I could try and bring humor into this, because that's what I try and do, you know, light and love into everything. And I cannot believe that we're dealing with things like this, but you got to laugh because the alternative is not what we're going to do here. So go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, and just real quick on that notion of bringing Gaza refugees into the United States, there's 21 Arab countries that surround Israel, and really what the U.S. and the U.N. and all good faith partners need to do is to be pressuring the Arab countries to take the Gaza refugees. And if they refuse to take one Gazan into their countries, then you have to ask yourself why. But so going back to the squad, which is really become the Hamas caucus, because they are the most, you know, vociferously vocal supporters of Hamas and advocating for what they call a ceasefire, which is really a way to keep Hamas in power indefinitely. And like you said, the chants of from the river to the sea, which would mean the elimination of the Jewish state of Israel. And what happens to the 7 million Jews who live in Israel? Nobody knows. They don't answer that question. You know, it's kind of like a who cares. And And, you know, the baseless accusations of Israel, their lies about Israel calling Israel a colonialist and apartheid state, where if you just, exactly, you know, anyone who has studied Israel for 5 minutes, who's gone to visit, knows that Arab citizens of Israel have every same benefit of any citizen, any other citizen. They have voting rights. There are Arabs who are members of the parliament. In fact, the last governing, the last governing coalition even had a member of an Arab party that's associated with the Muslim Brotherhood as a member of the governing coalition. Wow. There are Arab judges in Israel. You can just go down the list. There is no... They're, you know, again, Arab citizens of Israel, citizens of every faith in Israel, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Druze, everybody has the same benefits of citizenship. That's so, right. So these are all lies and accusations that our own members of Congress, you know, just these, make these libelous claims on the hallowed floors of the U.S. Congress. And so, so when it comes to the understanding the dynamic of this, this the squad, what I think, Seth, is important for us to understand is that this is a an alliance between the radical Islamists and the radical left. And what I like to share with people is that these, either of those groups onto themselves, are small and not all that powerful. So if you look at radical Islamists in the United States, small numbers, not all that power. You look at the radical left, small numbers, not all that much power. When you combine these groups together, they then become powerful and they then become much louder. And unfortunately, a force that has to be dealt with. And so this is this very strange alliance of forces that have what you would imagine no real values in common. And the and what I like to point out is that if you're in Gaza, homosexuality is illegal. It's forbidden. Yep, they murder, they hang people, they hang people, and they execute people for being gay. And yet you get weird, you know, weird alliances. People like, you know, Queers for Palestine and AOC, who is on the forefront of LGBTQ issues right now. She's aligning with the same people who would take her LGBTQ constituents and hang them from the crane, from a crane in the center of town. Yeah. How do you make sense of it? It doesn't make sense. It's a power grab.
I heard, and I try to bring light to things because it sometimes is the best way to connect. So to even think about the concept of Queers for Palestine boggles my mind. And I remember talking with an Israeli about that, and they go, "Oh, in Gaza? Yeah, it's like chickens for KFC. You're wanting your own death. It's like you know." And they said, you know, Jews would, if they went to Gaza, this was the joke the Israeli guy said, Jews in Gaza, they would be beaten up and taken and dragged and this and that. Gays, no, they'd just be shot in the head. It'd be quick, it'd be simple, you know, no worries, you know. It's insane to think that of Queers for Palestine, because they would want to kill them, folks. They would want to kill anybody who's LGBTQ plus, talking about their gender assignments, folks. I mean, anything in the United States or in any country that talks about these things, you would not be able to even talk about it in Palestine. And then just ask yourself, why during the negotiations when Gazans were trying to flee and go to Egypt or to Jordan, they closed the borders? They didn't take one of them. Why? So, folks, this is violence on steroids that's going on right now. And it's obvious that Ellie knows what's going on and we know what's going on, but doesn't it boggle your mind, these crazy alliances that have occurred? I mean, talk about, I know that the expression is in Washington, politics makes strange bedfellows, but this is Like, they wouldn't even be in the same together. Makes no sense. They kill them. It just makes no sense what's going on. It's almost illogical and boggles the mind as to how it could be allowed. And then, so how does that make you feel when you see these kinds of alliances occurring and you know that they're just false alliances?
Well, Seth, you know, I have to go back to that early history that I shared with you about the Islamic Revolution in Iran, because it was the same thing. What we saw with the Islamic Revolution was that the communists in Iran, and there was a communist party, that the communists, the radical leftists, the idealistic university students, many of whom were in the United States at the time, there were Iranian college students who were in the United States, and they were fomenting against the Shah of Iran while they were here on at American college campuses, protesting, fomenting, you know, very similar to the things we're seeing now. They were fomenting against the Shah in support of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And so we saw this radical Islamist leftist alliance. And what is the first thing that that happens when the Islamists take power? Well, the first thing they do is they literally execute the leftists. Right. They execute, they shun, they imprison. And so that, you know, we've seen this happen in history over and over again. And by the way, and what did they do to the women? Well, they immediately put into effect hijab laws, mandating that women have to wear veils. Now, under the Shah, yes, Iranian women had made such advances. You know, they were gaining in higher education. They were gaining in careers. If I showed you pictures of my mom in Iran in the 1970s, she's wearing, and 60s, she's wearing mini skirts. She looks, yep, like she could be in New York or Paris or London. And she was in Tehran at the time. Huh. So they took all of the advances and all of the freedoms that were gained under the Shah, and they immediately reversed them. And so that is what happens when the Islamists take power. When they're leading up to power, they will make all kinds of promises and lies to the left. When they gain power, the first to get killed are the left, and then the rest of society is placed into an oppressive system. We've seen this in Iran, where I was born, but we've seen it in places like Lebanon. We've seen it in Afghanistan. You know, you've seen it in Iraq. I can go up and down the list of countries, yep, that at one point in the Middle East were westernizing, were gaining advances in freedom for their entire society. And then you have these radical Islamists take wrench control, and the society is, you know, reversed back thousands of years to the Middle Ages.
Oh yeah. Thousands of years. It just boggles my mind to see the repressive reverse that occurred in the 1970s. I remember growing up seeing it, but I did not live it. I was living in a place where, believe me, I was feeling anti-Semitism, but nothing in comparison to that. Nothing. But it did get me involved back then, you know, in Zionism as well as in Soviet Jewry. But nothing, you know, I saw all of this happening and realized, as nowadays we're dealing with this Iranian proxy, and it all kind of like came full circle again. And it was like, whoa, we're living again in the 1970s, but in a more wartime way toward Israel. And it's like all of them coming at us at once again, like 1973. Don't you feel like we're almost living the 73 war again, but it's a lot longer?
Yeah, Seth, I would agree with that. So I was in Israel about a week and a half ago now. I went on a fact-finding mission, and yeah. I went to the southern communities that border Gaza to see with my own eyes the devastation of what took place there. And Seth, I have to tell you that even with everything that I had been seeing and reading before I went to Israel, you know, of course, I was closely tracking the Hamas attack and the war, but even with all of that, when I went there in person, it was devastating and shocking to me. I went to Kibbutz Kfar Aza. It's one of the kibbutz communities that on the southern border that was attacked on October 7th. And the way that the kibbutz is set up is that there's one area that that was really kind of like the younger families that had little kids and babies. And they lived in, so, you know, these are young families just starting out. So they live in these kind of smaller, very modest homes, much, you know, closely all attached homes in a row. And then the other side of the kibbutz the homes were a little bit more spread out, a little bit bigger, I guess, you know, kind of like the older, more established families lived on that other side of the kibbutz. But it's all very close to each other, and it's right over the border of Gaza. And what happened on October 7th is that terrorists attacked first the section where the younger families with the little babies and the little kids lived. And if you remember, October 7th was Saturday, so it's Shabbat. It's a Sabbath in Israel. It was also the Jewish holiday of Simchat Torah. So people are home with their kids. And so they were that much more vulnerable celebrating a Jewish holiday. And Seth, I have to tell you something. What I experienced just walking through the community and understanding the aftermath. If you look at my social media on my Instagram and Twitter, you'll see the videos that I took that day. The homes are riddled with bullets. And now, again, these are tiny little homes, and there's so many bullet marks on the outside and the inside, on the ceilings. I mean, these homes were attacked so hard that they're collapsed. You know, many of these small homes are just rubble. I went into some of the homes that were completely blackened, because those were the homes where the terrorists had burned the Jewish families inside alive. And so it just completely blackened. When you go to these communities, it's like time to stood still. They have left, they've left them as is, other than that they've washed the blood off the floors and the walls, but they've left it as is. And so what you can see also, what survivors described, is there's just a mass of possessions that are just kind of like a trail coming out of these homes. And what that is that, you know, Hamas terrorists infiltrated and led the way into these southern Israeli communities. But many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of Gaza civilians, quote unquote, then followed in the terrorists. And so what the survivors describe is that they came in and they participated in the killing of the Jews. They came in, these Gaza so-called civilians, they looted the homes. They watched what was happening and they were looting these homes. And so this is why you have these trail of possessions, because the civilians, quote unquote, then looted these homes while these killings are going on. The other thing that was described to me by one of the survivors, and I saw it with my own eyes, is that these civilians, quote unquote, who came in and didn't have weapons on them, they took gas canisters for barbecues. The barbecue grills are off, you know, just on the outside of these homes. Yep. And they took the barbecue gas canisters and they threw them at the homes and help explode these homes, again, burning the families alive inside them. So who were trying to keep safe away from the terrorists who were attacking them. I saw all of this with my own eyes, Seth. I spoke with survivors of the Kibbutz Kfar Aza, the Kibbutz Be'eri attacks. We also went to the southern city of Ofakim, where we spoke to two survivors there. And the horror of what took place on October 7th is very difficult for decent human beings to imagine. Seth, yeah. I saw the 46-minute video that the IDF compiled of Hamas's own GoPro cameras, of CCTV footage, and the footage from first responders. And what I saw was evil. I saw the face of evil, Seth. I saw evil that is indescribable. It hurts the soul to see what these animals, these barbarians, but satanic barbarians, what they did.
Yeah, they were satanic in the way they did it. Yes. Yes. You know, everybody remembers certain days where they were. So on October 7th, I was literally in a chat with people just to joke around because it was, you know, Shavua Tov right here in the United States. So we were just hanging out and I was on Clubhouse and somebody got me into a Telegram that was, let's just say jihadist in nature. And I got to see it almost real time. And it took me a while to be able to go to sleep at night afterwards, frankly. And I only saw a fraction of it. But I did see things that I will never not see again. I mean, they just are just ingrained in my head. So for you to watch that movie of the 47 minutes must be chilling to you, to say the least, in what occurred to not just men, but to women. And I really want to get to this question because I've been, I'll be careful in my words, but anxiously waiting to ask you this question, I think is the appropriate way. But the UN has just kind of turned a blind eye toward us, toward the Jews, toward Israel, and almost the United States, in fact. I'm mesmerized by it, and I'm also mesmerized by the, and I have to say this, and I never thought I'd ever say this on an air, but, well, I'm saying it, that I see all these people that were very Me Too, that were very against any form of an attack on a woman in the United States. All these, and I hate to use the word, but I'm going to use it, feminists that were, you know, advocating for women's safety and all that kind of stuff. And we're now dealing with the rape, the sexual violence, the things they cut, the way they played with them. I saw it all, and that stuff. And it's just, our UN is gone. It's like it doesn't matter anymore. It's almost like, you know, worthless stock. It doesn't matter. How does that make you feel as a woman? And I asked, I'm really curious about this. How does this make you feel after October 7th and the what occurred, the violence and satanic barbaric acts they did? And I'm not saying satanic just to say it, folks, because if you had seen the 47 minutes, you would understand that it was purely satanic what they did. To do what they did was satanic. So what does that, Ellie, I know you must be shooken to the core in many ways about this, besides Iran, living in it, there, having to leave, and then seeing this again, and then going to Israel. What does that make you feel or think?
Steph,
I'm sorry,
great
it's so
betrayal.
Hard to talk about. I can't even, you know, it's just even hard to ask the question for me. I'm trying to come up with words, and I'm sorry. I just it. Oh, you know, I'm trying to be pro-woman feminist my whole life, and you know, as long as I've can stand, and to see this is just so questionable. So go ahead, I leave it at that.
It is a great betrayal, Seth. It is a great betrayal because basically the message has been that, you know, me too, unless you're I'm a Jew. It's believe all women except Jewish women. You know, it's just been a complete abandonment of Israeli women who, like you said, what happened is that Hamas committed mass rape, the most horrible, unimaginable set crimes against humanity, sexual crimes against humanity, Hamas committed on October 7th. And right now, the Israeli police have amassed 1,500 survivor and witness testimony, along with forensic evidence, which shows that the mass rape of women by Hamas was actually premeditated. So this is, according to international law, these are war crimes. And so, Seth, to your point, the fact that it took the United Nations 57 days to just even condemn Hamas's war crimes against women is just unconscionable. And if the United Nations had any credibility before October 7th, they've really lost all credibility now. The fact that they just can't even condemn rape, you know, it's just a black and white issue. There's really no gray area here. They couldn't condemn rape by terrorists. If you can't condemn rape, I really just don't even know what you're here for. What is the point of the United Nations, you know, right now? So they've been an abject failure on you know, for this war. And then, so you talk about the women's groups. The women's groups also, you know, these are people who, you know, they claim to care about the issues that affect women. But again, you have a situation where rape was used as a tool of war, as a weapon of war. Again, it is considered a war crime according to international law, and yet right, the women's groups have been silent. So so basically, in their silence, you know, what is the message that could be understood? Are they saying that in some situations they're okay with women getting raped? Are there some situations of conflict where they're espousing rape? Is that what's going on here with the women's groups? Because that's what their silence seems to imply. And so they too have lost all legitimacy, Seth. All legitimacy. It's gone for them.
I wonder, I'm almost wondering how would they even recover? How do you recover? And they haven't even tried, like, in politics, the concept of a rapid response. They haven't even tried anything. They just have taken their hands and sat on them and gagged themselves, meaning put something in their mouth or taped their mouths, because they could care less when it comes to Israel and us. It's like anybody but ABJ, anybody but Jews. I'm still wondering how they plan in any election cycle to come to the U.S., not just to the U.S. How do they plan to even think to say the word feminist and have anybody think that they're serious or real or credulent? we're living in crazy times, Ellie. I ask these questions, and I know that they seem simple or they seem whatever, but I'm really perplexed. Well,
Seth, you know, they're simply standing on the wrong side of history. And this is the case also for the thousands of people we've been seeing that are marching for Hamas after October 7th, whether it's in our U.S. cities or on our U.S. college campuses. And of course, you know, in places like Europe where you're seeing hundreds of thousands of pro-jihadi people marching on the streets of these European cities. They're standing on the wrong side of history. You know, we are living in warped and strange times, but these are people who, you know, I don't casually make analogies to the Nazis and to the Holocaust, but October 7th was the deadliest day for Jews since the Holocaust, and the atrocities that were committed against the Jews were very similar in many ways to the atrocities that the Nazis committed against the Jews in the Holocaust. And so I cannot help but make this analogy. And I believe the ideology that drives Hamas, that drives the radical Islamists, that drives the Iranian regime, this is a Nazi ideology. This is an eliminationist ideology. They tell us they want to eliminate the Jews. They tell us they want to commit genocide against us again. They tell us that they want to, quote unquote, wipe Israel off the map, which means to kill 6 million, 7 million Jews again. Okay. They are telling us what they want to do. And they have picked up the legacy of the Nazis. They are today's Nazis. And so what needs to be clear to everyone is if you are pro Hamas, you're pro-Nazi, and you're on the wrong side of history. We are going through difficult times, Seth, but I am convinced that good always prevails over evil. We will prevail over this evil, and these people will go down in the history books, and they will get flushed down the toilet of history as the pro-Nazis that they are.
Yeah,
but it does require, I think, one of the other lessons of the Holocaust is that the good people cannot stand by silently. And so if there is a message that I could share with the audience is that it is time for all of us to make ourselves heard. We need to make ourselves heard loud and clear. We need to make ourselves heard to the members of Congress and to the Biden administration, because now they are starting to put pressure on Israel. They don't want to allow Israel to finish this war in the way that Israel must, which is a grand victory over Hamas, eliminating this terror group. This war has to end with Hamas being ended both militarily and politically. There can no longer be a Hamas at the end of Israel's war. Israel needs more time and space in order to do this, and we need the U.S. to support Israel in that effort. So if you're listening to Seth's podcast, there's a few things I'm asking you to do. Please call your local member of Congress and let them know, both your senators and your members of the House. Call them and tell them you stand in support of Israel. You want them to continue to support Israel in the war against Hamas as long as it takes Israel. As much munitions resupply and Iron Dome resupply as Israel needs, America needs to resupply Israel and pass the funding bill for Israel so that the Israelis can fight this war and finish Hamas. If you are listening to Seth's podcast, I'm going to ask you, if you hear about something anti-Semitic that happens in your community, speak up and demand that the local police make arrests. If there's a hate crime that happens, demand that your local district attorney prosecute hate crimes. Okay, we need hate crimes prosecuted. Yes. Otherwise, they will continue to grow and grow in this country. If you're listening to Seth's podcast and there's a local university on your campus, I'm sorry, there's a local university in your community, in your state, in your city, and something, they're holding a pro-Hamas rally, they're doing something anti-Semitic, get your voice heard to that university administration, to the president of the university. And if you're an alum of any of these colleges where, again, these anti-Semitic incidents are taking place, please call your college office, your alumni office, and make yourself heard and tell them, I'm going to give you a dollar this year, and I am no longer a proud alumni. You have embarrassed me. Yep. I'm not going to recruit from your campus. I'm not going to hire other alumni until you fix this. We cannot allow this growing anti-Semitism in our country, and we cannot allow support for Hamas terrorists.
Amen. Baruch Hashem, yeah. I thank you for saying that, Ellie, because these are the calls to action that we must bring loud and clear. And part of the reason why I'm doing these podcasts, because these kind of statements, like one you just made, are the gems that I will be bombarding social media with religiously. To let people know what they must do to help this, because this isn't just about Jews, folks. They're tearing down crosses on churches. They don't want any other religion, and this is radical Islamists. And I think that we need to be very careful if we're keeping ourselves silent. It's a very bad thing to do, because first they came for the, if you remember the poem, first they came for the Jews and then they come for. So they will come for you, and then what will happen? You'll have nobody to defend yourself, because that's really what it comes down to. Ellie, I am beyond grateful for your acts of service in the United States and the State Department and being tapped. And I'm grateful that you took the time to eloquently speak to me so that my listeners can effectively not just understand, but know what to do, because they should be enraged, upset, and understanding of what's going on. So to have advocates like yourself, is so important in this, and I'm just grateful, unfortunately, in this tough time, but I'm still grateful that you gave me the time to want to speak to me about this important issue. It really, we all are coming together, and it's a really nice thing to see. You know,
Seth, thank you. Thank you for wanting to dedicate your show to this subject. And I'm grateful to you for you know, sharing this important message with your audience and bringing everyone together on this. We certainly do need to unite. And you're exactly right about first they come for the Saturday people, then they come for the Sunday people. Right. And this, you know, pro-terrorist, pro-Hamas activity, this rising anti-Semitism that we're facing in the country, it will destroy the fabric of our society if we don't stop it now.
Right. That's correct. Because if you can allow terrorists, and I remember a time in this country when we used to say we don't negotiate with terrorists, but we are, right? It just mesmerizes me what time we're in, but we have to remain strong. And that's what I am doing, why I am giving of my podcast to this important issue. Because as they say, you know, keeping it real or keeping it green or whatever you want to call it, you know, the preservation of my people and myself is more important to me right now than, and I'm going to say this, and people might laugh, but I don't care. Folks, you back Greta Thunberg, How well does that treat you? I'm trying to bring green living, and now I'm trying to merge into it Judaism. And I believe that people have a lot to learn from the Jewish people. And I think we have a lot to tell, especially after October 7th. This was our wake-up call. Look, I've practiced. I keep kosher. I daven. I do everything. But I turned it up once October 7th happened. And I will be relentless about this for us, for the Jewish people, because it's not just as what I... Look, folks, this is not just about Judaism. As we said, first they come for the Saturday people, and then they come for the Sunday people. But it's also about women's rights. It's about real protection of LGBTQ plus communities. We are the fabric that is in tending to hold democracy together, not just here, but in the Middle East, where there is no democracy except for the state of Israel. So one, as I say, one small step at a time for green living. Well, one small step at a time today is listening to Eli Kohanim. I believe, I would assume, and for folks, your Instagram as well as your X is your name, correct? Right, Eli Kohanim.
Yes, exactly right. So if I can just spell it real quick, yeah, it's at Eli, which is E-L-L-I-E, and then Kohanim is C-O-H-A-N-I-M. It's all one word, at Eli Kohanim. I'm on Instagram and X and Facebook, so I do hope folks will find me there. And again, you can see the footage that I took in Israel on my social media as well.
And I will be sharing it after this podcast all over the place as soon as I'm sending this off to get edited. But Eli, thank you so much for your time. I would assume you have a website too, or yes, no?
Yeah. One day, not yet, not right now. But
okay,
but
fair enough.
I'm on every social media platform, and I'm pretty good. If people direct message me, I'm pretty good at getting back to them.
Yes, you are. Yes, you are, to say the least. You're very approachable. You're very. You can tell when a person is engaged and just gets it. And that's why I was very excited to hear from you, because I feel that you're very into speaking for the right thing and doing the right thing. And it's just great that you're here. It's unfortunate that we have met under these circumstances, but I am very grateful to have met you. I am very grateful to work with you, as we all are, to combat anti-Semitism and to explain to people what happened about October 7th and about Hamas and all of these terrorist groups working together in a proxy war, courtesy of the great country of Iran, which used to be really an amazing country called Persia, which had real rights, folks. And it all is part of this conversation that we're having today. If you go and you research Iran in the 1970s, it wasn't Iran, it was Persia, right? And somebody even told me, and I just want to ask you this.
Well,
last
no, wait,
question.
Seth, sorry. No, it was already Iran under the king of... Under the Shah, it was already Iran. Persia is the early, you know, early history of... under Cyrus the Great, and so it's the Persian Empire, which it's okay. Persian Empire later becomes Iran. So under the Shah, it was already Iran.
Okay, so but it I feel like it almost changed when when the Ayatollah Khomeini came in.
Yes.
The real question I had, though, and I just want to make this clear to people, is there are some videos going around showing how people in the area of the Palestine, and I could be wrong, but people in the Palestinian area before World War II ended were meeting with the Nazis to discuss an alliance of sorts. Have you seen any of those types of videos from way back when of them working together?
Yes. So what you're referring to is the Mufti of Jerusalem, who did actually, yeah, he did meet with the Nazis, and he actually went to Germany. And what he did was also broadcast in Arabic on a radio in the Arab world. He was broadcasting Nazi propaganda translated into Arabic, and a lot of the anti-Semitic ideology that we see right now in the Middle East, believe it or not, it actually does trace back to the Mufti of Jerusalem, who was, you know, at the time an Arab living in you know, pre 1948 in Palestine. Yes. And so he helped spread Nazi ideology, which to this day is thriving in the Middle East.
So that further gives context. And I just wanted to end with that question, really, because really, folks, what we are seeing is a continuation of Nazism. And we're not just saying it, but it's real, folks, a continuation of a Nazi ideology that has now fallen into the Free Palestine movement and has taken over definitely Hamas and all of these other terrorist groups in their ideology, which is kill the Jews. It's, you know, nothing but that. And I'm trying to bring light and levity to it, but it almost sounds like a bad Mel Brooks movie at this rate. Folks, I hope you can take today's one small step at a time and make it a little bit bigger. I usually say one small step at a time, but today we have to look at the evidence and what's going on and really come together against hatred and towards good. And one of the greatest people out there that I have seen speaking about this is here with us today, Eli Kohanim. So your one small step today, folks, is you got to follow her because she's just an amazing person and a powerhouse in this discussion, in this conversation. And she's really helping, Eli is really helping people to understand the connection back to Iran back then, you know, how Nazism is being infiltrated into what's going on with the Ayatollah, and how that hatred and that anger is really what's going on today toward Israel. And we have to stop it. We have to end it. As, I think as Sebastian Gorka put it best on his Instagram and social media channels after he saw everything, we have to kill Hamas. And we need to end this now, because if we don't and we ceasefire, it will only get worse and it will only spread. So, Eli, I'm with you. My fans, I'm telling you, my fans are with you. And we're going to be there to help you fight the fight. Help us fight the fight.
Thank you, Seth.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much for your time and willingness to give this space to talk about this with me, because I think it's time. I mean, I remember I was in the 1980s, I was interning for the Coalition of Free Soviet Jews, because it's, you know, there was a massive emigration from Russia back then. Now we're dealing, and it was because of hatred. And then it turned into something better, which was people can leave and emigrate. But I've been into Zionism my whole life because it's connected to Judaism by the hip, and we must stand together. So thank you all, everybody. Just realize that we're here to only talk about good and love, light, love and light. And I think that's what everything I do all the time when I try these podcasts. So we're going to just continue with that, but we're going to talk about hate and we're going to stand in front of it and say no. That's what we're going to do. As I always say, peace.
You've been listening to the Green Living Guy Show with your host, Seth Lightman. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We really appreciate that effort. Until next time.